Hi friends, welcome to the Bible Project Daily Podcast. And today we're picking up in Luke 19, and we're going to be looking at 15 verses from verse 29 to 44. And I've called today's message, today's study, When Jesus Comes. Now as you know, there are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. As you no doubt also know, three of them are very similar. They follow the same basic outline and in fact contain a high percentage of overlap. They describe the same incidents in the life of Christ, agreed sometimes from slightly different perspectives. The Gospel of John, however, is radically different. John focuses almost solely on Jesus' ministry in Jerusalem. If we didn't have the Gospel of John, we wouldn't in fact know that he spent almost 3 years of his ministry there, because this records just how many times he exited and went back again to Jerusalem. But while the Synoptic Gospels, as we call them, Matthew, Mark and Luke, don't spend a lot of time with Jesus in Jerusalem during his ministry period, boy, do they really end up there. If we took out what happens at the very end of his life from this point forward out of these gospel accounts, you would actually pull a huge chunk out of Matthew, Mark and Luke, because all three of them choose to concentrate in the latter part of their gospel accounts on literally the last week of Jesus' life. Matthew, Mark and Luke initially focused on the ministry of Christ in Galilee, and then he shows up in Jerusalem. And that's where, from this point forward, he will face his trials, and we'll even witness his crucifixion and the resurrection and so forth. Now, we've been going through the Gospel of Luke together for nearly 70 episodes now, over 2 months, and we've been doing it verse by verse. But there is one factor: when we approach something like this in such details, it's very easy to miss something. If you were to read the Gospel of Luke all the way through in one go without stopping, I would suggest you'd probably notice how often it refers to Jesus, the fact that he's going to Jerusalem. It started way back in Luke chapter 9 when Luke recorded for us, 9:51, it says, "Now it came to pass, when the time had come to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face towards Jerusalem." So way back in chapter 9, Luke in the text takes a point of time to say, hey, pay attention, Jesus is now leaving Galilee and he's going to head towards Jerusalem where all this stuff is going to happen. But then we've had 10 chapters and it's taken that long for him to arrive there, which is what we're seeing there today. And through these 10 chapters, we've seen him visit several places, teach using parables, miracles, healings, etc., etc. But now, in chapter 19, we see he finally gets to Jerusalem, and that's what we're going to look at today. The Lord is finally entering Jerusalem. The Lord has come. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record these events, and we've looked at them twice before. But today we're going to read Luke's version, which is Luke 19, verses 28 to 44. And I want to try and get something different out of this famous passage to what I drew out of it the last two times. Something that I believe Luke particularly wants us to understand. So with that in mind, let's jump into the text to where we left off. Thank you for joining me again here today, and welcome to the Bible Project Daily Podcast. Okay, here we go, picking up exactly the very next verse after which we left off last time. Beginning at 19, verse 28 in the Gospel of Luke, it tells us this. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethpage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you why you are untying it, just say the Lord needs it." Those who were sent went ahead and found it just as it was told to them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, "Why are you untying the colt?" They replied, "The Lord needs it." They then brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down to the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples and followers began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." "I tell you," he replied, "if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." And he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, and he wept over it. And he said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another, because you did not recognize the time of God coming to you." Okay, a familiar passage to many, I'm sure. What I've just read to you is what is commonly referred to as the triumphal entry, sometimes also called the Palm Sunday passage, owing to the tradition of people throwing palm branches in Jesus' path and waving them at him as he entered Jerusalem. Now, the key question we might ask is, what significance can we draw from this account of Jesus simply entering Jerusalem? Well, the story, I believe, holds deep importance on many levels, underscored by the fact that, as I said in the introduction, it's recorded in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, with significant details provided in each account. So let's look at Luke's account today, and it began for us in verse 29, when it simply says that he's on the road to the Mount of Olives. Now, to understand the geography here, remember Jerusalem is situated on a hill. Descending down one side leads to the Kidron Valley, and beyond that another hill, the Mount of Olives, which stands 3,300 feet higher than Jerusalem itself. Tourists even today often visit this spot for its panoramic view of the Jerusalem, which today not only includes the temple site, but also, of course, the Dome of the Rock. The mosque is in clear sight. Jesus and his disciples here on this day are descending now from the Mount of Olives, as indicated in the passage. So they're transversing the valley and they're ascending the slope on the other side to enter the city. Now, many events will unfold in the city after this section of scripture I've read. We'll see some tumultuous events in the life of Christ, and one might say the life of Jerusalem, very soon. In the meantime, Jesus now takes this opportunity to instruct two of his disciples in particular, likely Bible experts say Peter and John, and he instructs them and tells them to go to a nearby village and find a colt, it said in my translation, which of course is just a reference to a young, not fully grown donkey, one that will be tied up there. Now, there's a sense here in which Jesus is seen to display supernatural knowledge, because he knows about this donkey's presence in advance. And indeed, the disciples, upon reaching the village, do indeed find the donkey, just as Jesus described. What's noteworthy, I think, a little thing that's easy to miss, a small little reference, is that the owners of the donkey also recognize Jesus as Lord, and they readily allow the disciples to take it when they mention that the master has need of it. Verse 32 confirms that the disciples find the situation exactly, precisely as Jesus foretold. And then in the following verse, we see them untying the donkey. The owners questions them, saying, "What are they doing it for?" And of course, they just reply simply, "Our Lord has need of it." Now, notice the use of the term "they." It seems to me that more than one person owned this donkey. And Bible experts, some believe that implied in this phrase, the fact that they are untying the donkey, it's the owners who untie the donkey, and it's the fact there's more than one of them, is significant because it suggests that the owners of this little animal were very likely very poor. In other words, they'd pulled the resources to acquire this donkey. Furthermore, we note the donkey doesn't even have a saddle, or maybe even a saddle cloth, indicating again further its humble condition, the humble condition of its owners. Yet still the owners give the donkey over, it's brought to Jesus, and it appears they place their own clothes on it as seating for Jesus to sit on it. Now additionally we say the crowd spreading their cloaks, their clothes on the road, also indicating their excitement and honour for celebration, if you like, of Jesus arising in the city of Jerusalem. Let's just focus for one more moment on verse 32, because it says, "And as they went on their way, they found it just as he had said to them." I think that phrase and the fact that things panned out exactly as Jesus said is worth noting, because I think we should take it as an encouragement to rely on the reliability of Jesus' instructions. I wonder if you've ever found yourself in a situation where your ideas conflict with what Jesus suggests we should do in scriptures, where we feel there must be, in many ways on human level, another way, even a better way. Well, I think this verse, as a secondary factor, emphasizes that when our understanding clashes with what we feel God's clear guidance is, it's crucial to trust in that rather than in our own understandings. As Proverbs, in fact, says, we shouldn't rely solely on our own understanding, but rather, Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6 tell us, acknowledge God in all his ways, and he will direct our paths. So when our perspective contradicts with his, it is essential to follow his lead, because further down the road of life, I believe we will realize that things are just as he said, not as we imagined. Anyway, moving back and forward in the narrative, the crowd bursts into proclamations and praises for the Lord. This is first seen in verse 36. They're laying their clothes on the road, as I said, as Jesus is approaching the descent of the Mount of Olives, and this entire multitude, so it's describing a large group of people, which includes the disciples, they're seen to be rejoicing and praising God, loudly celebrating the mighty works that many of them have witnessed on this 10-chapter journey to Jerusalem. And mixing with the people locally, there seems to be this spontaneous outpouring of praises, underscoring the crowd's recognition of Jesus as the Messiah, demonstrated they have seen through miracles and power being testified to here. Now, the crowd welcoming Jesus into Jerusalem is ostensibly the same crowd that will probably, a significant number, will be among those who are demanding his crucifixion within a week. So the contrast here is stark. It's meant to be stark. Here are people praising him, and what's significant is that these are likely a mixture of people from Galilee who saw Jesus performing miracles, as well as people who witnessed him arriving in Jerusalem for the Passover, and those he picked up along the way through his life and ministry and making a decision to follow him. So essentially, upon arrival, his own community growing and beswelled with the people from the suburbs of Jerusalem. Those who have seen the wonders and are now witnessing to him and what he's done as he enters into the city, drawing more and more people into the cavalcade. The words in verse 38 that we hear the people shout along the lines of "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory to the highest," it reveals that certainly there is a recognition of Jesus as royalty as they see it, as the Messiah, and further demonstrated as they lay their clothes on the road before him, a gesture of submission and great honour. So they're acknowledging him as the long-awaited Messiah, but also as the King. Now, Luke doesn't dwell on this in the same way as Matthew did, and that's the perspective I focused on when I looked at Matthew. So if you want to think about that, I haven't heard that before, drop back and look at my account in Matthew 19, I think it is. Because remember, Matthew was writing to a Jewish audience, and he's emphasizing by quoting Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah concerning the entry into Jerusalem. The key point here is the imagery being used here is significant. You see, when a king rode a horse, it was symbolizing a readiness for war. But when he entered a city, sometimes a conquered city, he would ride on a donkey to signify he arrives in peace, just as Jesus does here. So Jesus's choice of a donkey for his triumphal entry highlights he's bringing his role as, yes, there's kingship to it, but ultimately he's a bringer of peace. And the crowd understands this, or at least partly does, because they acknowledge that they welcome him as king, but also proclaim peace in heaven and on earth. Now, this notion of Jesus the Messiah as the one who brings peace isn't new. Of course, it's echoed very much in the opening verses of Luke's Gospel, where the birth of Jesus was foretold, and with the proclamation to the shepherds of peace on earth and goodwill to all men. And now, today, as we see Jesus enter Jerusalem, the crowd also recognizes him as the king, but the king who will bring peace. Or at least they recognize him in that way at this point. So it's really worth noting the contrast between Jesus riding a donkey and symbolizing peace, and the very different imagery of him returning on a horse, a white horse, a white charger, a horse of war in Revelation, denoting judgment. Here, Jesus comes, as it's described, empty-handed, a sign of peace, a stark contrast to the eventual scene of judgment depicted in Revelation when Jesus returns in the character of the conquering king for judgment.
Hi, this is Ashley T. Lee Podcast. Join me to hear the Bible read line by line and clearly explained. Listen to the Word of God in your car or home or work while it transforms your mind daily. Romans 12:2 says, "Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, which is good and acceptable and perfect." Knowing the Bible can give you peace and joy in this hectic world. Listen weekly to Ashley T. Lee Podcast on all podcast sites.
Just as an aside, this reference about Jesus arriving empty-handed, I wonder if you know the origin of the handshake. Now, there are several explanations, but they all pretty much say the same thing. The oldest one goes back to the ancient times, even before this, when two strangers met. Initially, of course, they'd be cautious, and the protocol was to lower their daggers and circle around each other, thereby deeming the encounter non-hostile. Then of a gesture of peace, they would extend an open empty hand and offer to shake it. Interestingly, traditionally to this day, it is men who in the majority shake hands, possibly because the long history that this has grown out of a time when women didn't carry swords, so they didn't need to show their empty hands as a sign of peace. They could approach each other and even hug without any danger of a secret stabbing, as it were. So the symbolism here is crucial. This being described as this extended empty hand signifies peace, just as Jesus entering Jerusalem on the donkey symbolized peace. The whole idea is he is arriving devoid of any weaponry of war. And the people welcome Jesus, hailing him as king, proclaiming his arrival as what they believe will bring in peace. Now, the way in which they bring in peace, well, I covered that in Matthew, and we maybe had a level of misunderstanding about that, and that is exemplified here in the Pharisees seeing all this going on and being displeased. In fact, in Luke's account, we see the Pharisees urging Jesus to be silent, to silence the crowd as well, because they're fearing political repercussions. If Pilate heard of another potential king coming in, then that is going to store up problems for them and the whole system. But Jesus, instead of complying, responds with his incredibly bold statement, which he says, even if these people were silenced, the very stones would cry out. This event, this official entry of Jesus into Jerusalem, is deeply significant because it's the first time we hear he marks his declaration himself as Messiah for everyone to hear. So picture the scene. Jesus recognizes the Messiah by the crowd, recognized the one as bringing peace, not only this time by his Galilean disciples, but the followers he's gathered on the way, also contrast and confront sharply with the Pharisees and their disapproval of him arising in Jerusalem. And at this point, there's a new level to Jesus' message coming. He's making prophecy. He talks about the fact that he's not even going to pause to weep over Jerusalem. You see, there's even more of Jesus' message to come. He makes this prophecy, then he says about not before he pauses to weep over Jerusalem. Now, his tears on the surface may seem to stem from the city's rejection of him, reflecting the missed opportunities to embrace salvation, but this moment also encapsulates that critical point, this critical juncture, when Jesus, the Prince of Peace, entering Jerusalem amidst celebration and this sort of controversial response of the Pharisees, we see him weeping for Jerusalem, foreshadowing his sacrificial role as Messiah. Those who understood Jesus' message embraced this peace, whilst those who reject him, like the Pharisees and the city of Jerusalem later, they miss out on the opportunity to experience the benefit of Christ's substitutionary atonement on behalf of the people. This rejection would later manifest itself in the city literally crying out for Jesus' crucifixion. As Jesus gazed upon the city of Jerusalem, he weeps. He's deeply moved by the lost opportunities that come because the moment has arrived where he declares his full messiahship. He declares the opportunities for peace and salvation, but he knows that some will reject it. His tears reflect the sorrow he feels for both the city's spiritual rebellion and for the impending judgment that will come upon all people. So in this pivotal moment in the text, Jesus is emphasizing the significance, how important it is to recognize him as the one who brings peace, the Prince of Peace. And he's lamenting here because he's wishing, if you like, he's saying, I only wish that these people could experience the peace. Instead of face impending judgment, that they would experience the peace of God. And many would say what is symbolized, the underlying symbol of this prophecy, refers to Jerusalem's destruction by the Romans just 30 or 40 years later in AD 70. So there's a judgment here, a prophecy foretold by Jesus, which was the consequence of the city's failure to recognize him and embrace the peace he offers, with the fall of the city itself and the destruction of the temple itself. So understanding this passage within the broader context of the other Gospels underscores the profound significance of it. Jesus' triumphal entry, as I've said before, marks a critical moment in his earth ministry. This is the point at which it turns. This is a point in where we're leading up to the final week of his life and to his crucifixion. Yet the practical lesson that was there as an opportunity for them to grasp today and still lies for us today is the opportunity to recognize Jesus as the source of peace in life. But the other side of that means that those who reject that peace will face the other side of the coin, which is justice, judgment, turmoil, whilst those who accept him can truly find peace. Now, let me conclude today by emphasizing two simple statements about this peace of God that Jesus is bringing in here. Firstly, it is that the presence of Jesus brings peace, yes, and when Jesus enters into any situation, peace will accompany them, but that peace is twofold. It is in the form of peace with God and the peace of God. Now, the peace with God is attained through faith in Jesus Christ, as outlined across the New Testament many times. Paul does it beautifully for us in many passages. Just one in my head we might want to look at right now is Colossians 1, where Jesus is seen to reconcile us to God through his coming sacrifice on the cross. But the peace of God, on the other hand, is also experienced in our daily lives when we surrender our worries and anxieties to him, as described in passages like Philippians 4:6, where we're told that it is a peace that surpasses humans' understanding and guards our hearts and mind. Notice how Paul and other writers, New Testament writers, unpack for us the various ways that God brings peace, not only in terms of our relationship with God, but between two people. In the Philippians 4 passage, he urges unity, and he actually quotes two quarrelling women in the local church he's writing to, and he encourages gentleness between them and towards others, and advises that community, that faith community in Philippi, against any form of anxiety. Now, this sort of list format is quite rare in Paul's writing, but he does use it on occasion in other versions, in other places like 1 Corinthians chapter 5. In both cases, in the Philippians and the Corinthians passage, Paul is providing clear directives of highlighting the importance of obedience in maintaining that peace, maintaining that harmony, that thing that has been gifted by God to us by his reconciliation on the cross within church communities that exist thereafter and right down to this day. The reason Paul issues it as a series of almost commands, if you like, in Philippians and in other places, he's wanting to address the common problem that is often found within churches. Yes, we have peace with God of individuals, but we're choosing not to live in peace with each other. So Paul, in his practicalities, remember, writing between 20 and 40 years after these events, Paul is wanting to give those who have benefited from the salvation wrought by Christ the clear directives of how to keep and restore any loss of harmony within any church congregation. And in the practicalities of the situation in Philippi, he simply urges that the woman involved in the breakdown, what has led to a division in the church, to reconcile. Paul then says that by doing this and living this way as churches and churches community, we're able to not only have reduction in anxiety, not worry about things, but gives us a toolkit, if you like, to fix conflicts when they might arise between individuals. Anything that might disrupt the peace of the congregation of Christ, the peace that was won at a great cost by Christ on the cross. And Paul ultimately therefore encourages us to focus on rejoicing in the Lord and maintaining a spiritual gentleness and entrusting all our concerns to God through prayer. By addressing conflicts biblically and seeking resolution in this way, the church forever, from this point in time forward of Christ's entry into Jerusalem, can not only experience but maintain the peace won this day. So by following these principles, we can experience not only peace with God, that was won at the cross of Calvary, but the peace of God amongst each other by living in a godly way. It's crucial for all Christians to believe that our peace isn't meant to be dependent on external circumstances. Anyone can experience peace momentarily when everything's going smoothly, but true peace is found in the midst of turmoil and trouble. That's the peace being offered here. That's the peace being described by Paul in Philippians and Corinthians. And the reaction of Jesus, as seen here on this day, to the Pharisees in their response to arrival in Jerusalem, is the response that is seen, because essentially these guys are rejecting the offer of peace with God and peace with one another. Those who reject Jesus reject peace. And by rejecting peace, you by nature lead to a situation where you live without peace and with conflict and eventually with judgment. Conversely, those who accept Jesus will receive both peace with God and within ourselves. Therefore, it is imperative to understand the presence of Jesus, whether on that day riding on a donkey or today as we sit, wherever we sit, wherever we're listening to this, the presence of Jesus is meant to bring peace. And the other side of that, recognizing that the rejection of Jesus will lead to the rejection of peace in our life. Whether we have peace in our heart is always determined to whether we have Jesus in our heart. As 2 Thessalonians 3:16 states, "May the Lord of peace himself give us peace always and in every way, regardless of our circumstances." So let's remember, friends, let's remember that this passage tells us to recognize Jesus, to know Jesus, and to know peace. And let's lean on him for that peace, because the Bible also tells us that it is a peace that surpasses all understanding, and it comes from entrusting our lives and our concerns into God's hands. I'll leave it there for today. Okay, friends, thanks for joining me. Can I suggest, if you've not done it before, why not subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss another single episode. And also, can I suggest, if you're interested, that there's a Patreon community which you can join, and you can participate in being the community of people that has arisen out of this podcast series. It's also the place where I host bonus episodes, things that are not part of the main Bible Project podcast, but that's the place where you'll find loads and loads of bonus episodes and materials on other things in very different areas. It's also the place where you can reach out and connect with me and the community, and you can even support this ministry if you feel God's calling you to do that. So with that all said, I'll leave it here for today and say thanks again for being here. My name's Jeremy McCandless, and you've been listening to the Bible Project Daily Podcast. Bye-bye for now.